So, Dr. Eric Chudler, what are some senses that humans don't have, but maybe others in the animal kingdom do?
Yeah, we think as humans we're always better than other animals, but we're not. A lot of animals have senses that we don't have. One example would be sharks. Sharks have special receptors in their snouts that detect electrical fields. So when fish or people are moving in the water, our muscles are generating a little bit of electricity. So that's one thing that animals have that we don't have. Another example would be rattlesnakes. So rattlesnakes have special pits that have receptors that detect a heat or the infrared portion of the electromagnetic spectrum. And so you may have seen on TV the little mouse that's running around and the snake's trying to find it, and the mouse looks all orange. And that's actually the body heat that special cameras are using to pick up the heat given off by that little mouse. Well, a snake, a rattlesnake, a pit viper, has these special cells that can actually find in complete darkness an animal, a human, just by the heat that's given off by their body.
You're killing me here. Why has it got to be all the terrifying animals? Are there any nice animals that have nice senses rather than, you know, frightening killing machines that are just even more efficient at hunting me down?
Sure. How about a butterfly?
I like butterflies.
So, butterflies and other insects can see into the ultraviolet range of the electromagnetic spectrum. So when you see a flower, you see particular colors. But because butterflies and other animals can see ultraviolet light, that flower looks actually very different to them. And so they can find and land on a flower that's of interest to them.
If you could acquire a sense from the animal kingdom that humans don't have, what would you choose?
I think detecting heat would be good. You'd actually be able to see in the dark. But again, it's not the eyes that are seeing the heat in the snake. Rather, it's their special receptors in the pits that are seeing heat. So I'd like to be able to see in the dark, just like a rattlesnake could see in the dark.
Could I evade the killer rattlesnake by covering myself in mud like Arnold Schwarzenegger did in Predator?
There's something out there waiting for us. And it ain't no man.
Likely you could, because if you could prevent your body heat from being detected, that would be an effective way to avoid the Predator.
That is Dr. Eric Chudler. Well, he's the one who was talking a second ago, not the one who's screaming. He's a UW bioengineering professor, and he's going to be back later in the show today as we explore the theme of senses. That happens a little later in the hour, but first, we're joined by three journalists who are so sharp they could defeat the Predator on their wits alone. We're going to talk over the week's news. Stick around. We are going to try and make some sense of this week's news now with our sound effect blue ribbon panel of news nerds. Does anybody object to being called a news nerd?
Not at all.
No. I embrace it.
Okay, thank goodness. All right, so I'm welcoming today Joanne Silberner, who's a freelance reporter and a journalism instructor at the University of Washington. Luke Timmerman is founder and editor of The Timmerman Report, which is a subscription-based news site on biotechnology. And Emily Parkhurst is digital managing editor at the Puget Sound Business Journal. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Sound Effect.
Great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Absolutely.
We're going to be getting to our underreported stories of the week in just a moment. But first, we are going to chew over the week's top story. And this week, we're going to be talking about the rolling teacher walkouts. And in case you haven't been paying attention, teachers will be going on one-day strikes. And some districts have already done this. Seattle teachers and a few others will be doing it on May 19th. It's going to be affecting a lot of students, a lot of parents, and potentially some politicians. So for starters, maybe we could get a quick recap on why they're doing this. Emily Parkhurst, can you sort of remind us where this story bubbled up from?
Seems like the main crux of the case for the teachers is that they're really concerned about teacher salaries and class size, but also how that relates to the McCleary decision. I get the impression that they do not feel like the Senate and House budget bills adequately answer the requirements of the McCleary decision, and they're pushing for better funding.
So, Joanne Silberner, does this strike you as something that's likely to be effective? Are we likely to expect a lot of blowback from this?
Well, this is Seattle, and everything is done in a polite way and building consensus. So the question is, will this build consensus? I don't know. I think that it will certainly bring attention to the issue. Will it make the Senate and the House suddenly get together and figure something out? There's not a long history of that. I'm pessimistic.
Based on what?
Well, based on what they've done with university funding, which I'm more familiar with. You know, when I started teaching in 2010, I had students who, when they graduated in 2014, were paying twice the tuition because the legislature's been pulling back a little bit on the funding for the university. So given that reluctance, you know, there's certainly more attention on the K through 12 kids, but I just don't see a great track record in coming through for education.
Yeah. And I wonder who the constituents are of this in some ways. I mean, is it a laser aimed at the legislature? Is this supposed to get parents mobilized to go bug their lawmakers? Is this supposed to get districts mobilized? I mean, who's this for?
Well, I don't know who it's for, but it definitely will get the attention of the parents, a large chunk of the voting public, and I think that would be part of the intent. And I think there's a tendency to look at this in narrow terms. You know, parents who may have heard about the McCleary case on the radio at some point, but haven't really thought much about it. Well, now suddenly it's in your face. You've got to arrange childcare for your kid because the teachers are walking out for a day. And I think a lot of people tend to get irritated by that. So there's a potential it could backfire on the teachers to an extent. But I try to remember, too, that these sorts of issues shouldn't be interpreted in a vacuum. So there's, you know, the teachers want a fair deal. They want better salaries and working conditions and class sizes. But they're also citizens. They live here just like us and deal with a lot of the same issues. And I think people sometimes forget that. They're just trying to, you know, put a roof over the head and food on the table, too.
Right. And it's interesting that this, you know, unlike a lot of strikes that are around a contract negotiation or something like that, this is being billed as a strike on issues, a strike based on a desire to get full funding for schools. You know, it's for the children, right? Not, they say it's not for us, it's for the children. And you can interpret that however you want. But I'm just curious, Emily Parkhurst, because you're steeped in business journalism, this has been a huge issue in the business community, at least, you know, vocally anyway. Whether or not they put their money where their mouth is another question, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we hosted a forum recently with a bunch of business leaders, and one of the number one issues that they were citing was the education and the lack of education in this state, and that they're really struggling to find qualified workers, and they want to find them locally, but they're not. And they're really, you know, emphasizing funding education. But like you just said, there's also this question of, okay, so where does that funding come from? And I think the business community could definitely partner more directly with the education community and really try and push this issue forward, particularly in Olympia.
Yeah.
And on the funding problem, you know, this is a state that just pretty much reflexively votes down most new taxes. Mm-hmm. So the legislators are looking at the voting history and saying people just don't want to pay taxes. There's got to be connect at some point that you get what you pay for. You know, if we want educated people who can go work at Google and Microsoft, we're going to have to start doing a lot more on the education in K through 12 and also at the university level. But again, traditionally, we just keep voting down taxes and voting down taxes. I'm new to Seattle, and I'm continually mystified at how you can have the desire on one hand to improve things and the insistence of not funding it.
Well, if you're ever going to improve upon some of these things, now would seem to be the time. The economy is on the upswing, and we're a sales tax heavy state, and so sales tax receipts are up. They're certainly not as bad as they were during the down years. So this is a good test. I mean, is this something we really value or not?
Well, you're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer here with Joanne Silberner, Luke Timmerman, and Emily Parkhurst talking over the week's news. We're going to move now into our underreported stories of the week. Emily, what's your nominee?
My nominee is actually a story that I wrote myself. I've been working for the past year and a half on high-tech immigration and how that affects the Puget Sound region, where Microsoft is the largest tech company employer of high-tech visa holders in the country. And you only have to walk through Bellevue and Redmond to realize that there's an enormous number of high-tech immigrants here in this region. And so what I looked into is what happens to them when they get here. in a lot of cases, they have to wait more than a decade for a green card, and they have to stay in their job. They cannot be promoted, and they cannot go out and start companies.
They can't be promoted.
It's against the law for them to be promoted while they're on an H-1B visa. So they are stuck in those positions for a decade or more. Their wives cannot work unless they apply for a green card.
Or their husbands.
It is it is primarily women, though, who are stuck. You can go to these apartment buildings over in Redmond and in Bellevue, and they're just full of highly educated women who are just sitting around all day because it's against the law for them to work.
Oh,
and there
wow.
have been some changes to those laws, but still there's an enormous number of people who can't work, and that has a huge impact on our community.
Did you go spend time with those bored, overeducated spouses?
I did, and there's an enormous amount of frustration there. They really want to work. They want to contribute to the community, and unless they're tech workers themselves, they can't.
Well, part one of that two-part investigative series just out from Emily Parkhurst in the Puget Sound Business Journal. And thanks for that underreported story. And how about you, Luke? What's your underreported story?
Well, I think the federal research budgets have been being cut for several years now. And this affects Seattle as a research town with the University of Washington, Fred Hutch, and other institutes here. And maybe a lot of people don't realize this, but the federal government made a big investment in biomedical research about 10 years ago, doubled that allocation. And it benefited regions like Seattle that are strong in research. We brought in a lot more researchers and the graduate students and postdocs that work for them on their projects. And when the budgets flattened out and were cut by things like sequestration, remember that term? You know, we're still living with some of that legacy. And so it's created a problem. There's just not enough places for the young people to go further their careers. They can't go get a faculty job at another university because they don't exist. There's no funding for it. And they're not being well prepared to go work at industry. So the result is you've got almost this kind of lost generation of young scientists that don't really know where to go. They're struggling to find alternative careers where they can use some of what they've learned in science in some other way. And so there's a lot of anxious young people in our community trying to find their way forward.
Well, the decline in federal research budgets and its effect on the Puget Sound biomedical research community. That's Luke Timmerman's underreported story. And how about you, Joanne Silberner? You're up. What's your underreported story?
Well, mine's a little more personal. It's the weather. You know,
I definitely don't hear enough about the weather.
Yeah. But, you know, I keep reading about what's happening in California, what's happening maybe a little in Arizona, how they're running out of water, they're changing their lawns, they're doing this, they're doing that. And then I heard just a one-liner that we have the lowest amount of snowpack in the 64 years of it being measured. And I came here I lived in Atlanta for a year before I came here, and when I got to Atlanta, we were taking showers with buckets, and you would take the bucket of the leftover shower water and put it, if you wanted any water for your lawn, that was it. You know, we're not used to that here. And are we going to have it? I mean, maybe there's enough reserves from last year or the year before. I don't know. Do I need to change what I'm doing in my garden? Am I going to be paying more for water? Are there going to be city initiatives or county initiatives that will help us conserve water? I don't know. All I know is that, we're going to have less water.
I think that there is a lot of concern about wildfires coming up this summer. And also the snowpack is not going to melt down and fill all of the rivers. There's concern about electricity and producing enough electricity for the state, let alone exporting that electricity outside of the state.
Yeah, part of the disconnect seems to be that we hear about this a lot with California. And here we are in Seattle, and we see the same things, the lack of snowpack, the lack of rain, and we're wondering, well, why are we just hearing about California?
Well, all right. I wish there were some reporters out there who could figure this out. Well, we're going to use that to conclude our underreported stories this week. And I want to thank Joanne Silberner, journalism instructor at the University of Washington, freelance reporter, Luke Timmerman, founder and editor of The Timmerman Report, which covers biotechnology, and Emily Parkhurst, digital managing editor at Puget Sound Business Journal. We really appreciate you guys being back on Sound Effect. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. So for starters, Dr. Chudler, maybe you could just rattle off what our senses are. What are the human senses?
Well, we talk about our five major senses, which are vision, hearing, smell, touch, and taste. But we actually have a lot more than just the five senses. And in fact, even vision can be divided into several different senses. I mean, we have receptors for color, and these are different than receptors for seeing black and white, for example.
So vision has some extras. What else you got?
Well, we have touch can also be divided. We have itch. We have a muscle sense. We have a joint position sense. This would be a proprioception and kinesthesia. We also have receptors for detecting chemicals and temperature, stretch and pressure.
So you think itch and warmth are different?
Yes, and they can be activated by different types of stimuli.
So you just rattled off like five or six touch ones, or ones that are located in the skin that have typically been associated with touch that you say are actually subtly different kinds of senses. Are there others?
Sure. One is located in our ears. So we think about hearing, but also in our inner ear, we have a sense of balance. So in our semicircular canals, we have a series of fluid-filled canals. And when we move around, those fluid moves and it activates hairs. And that tells us about our sense of balance. So that's another one. And also gravity and acceleration. Those are also senses that we have.
What are we talking about here? 10, 20, dozens?
Well, it depends on how you would want to separate them. I mean, some people might lump everything together from our skin as a single sense. But because I think we have different receptors that respond to a specific type of stimulus, that they should be separate.
Wow. So why do we all learn in elementary school, or at least through the 70s or whatever, that we have five senses, that it's sight, smell, hearing, touch, taste?
Yeah, it may be that those are just the easiest ones to test. Certainly vision and hearing, there's a good portion of our brain that's devoted to those senses. So those are easy to test. A large portion of the brain actually is devoted to vision. Is probably the most part of the brain that for a particular sense. But we certainly have other senses, but they're not as easy and not as visible. In fact, not only do we have these five senses that tell us about the outside world, we have other senses that tell about the inside world, inside of our bodies. For example, blood pressure. We have special receptors in our cardiovascular system that tells us about blood pressure. Inside of our viscera, inside of our stomach. Whenever you're hungry, you can feel your stomach move.
I was just thinking about that. It's okay. I'm hungry right now. And I was thinking, like, where do we draw the line? Is a sense of hunger a sense? And you're saying, yeah, maybe, right?
I would say it is. It's telling us about the environment of our body. So instead of the environment of the outside world, it's telling us about the environment inside of us. Thirst and hunger are other senses.
One thing that occurs to me, and some people might have heard of, a number of blind people have been able to teach themselves to echolocate or something like that. That's where you can, they'll click or they'll make a noise and they will interpret the way that those sound waves bounce back to their ears and form a spatial picture in their mind. Mm-hmm. So is that a new sense that they taught themselves, or is that really just hearing in a different way?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. One, what happens when someone loses a sense is that that part of the brain that was devoted to that sense that was lost gets taken over by another sense. So, for example, if someone becomes blind, that part of the brain just doesn't sit there idle. Rather, that part of the brain looks for something to do, and it can be taken over by another sense.
So you got your visual cortex, your little visual center in the brain. It doesn't like just get unplugged and turn off. It looks for new wires.
That's exactly right, and that's the process called neuroplasticity. And if we can understand more about how the brain is plastic and how neuroplasticity works, perhaps we can help people who have these types of disabilities.
Can I use neuroplasticity to acquire spider sense?
A spider sense? Probably not, because we need those receptors out in our skin or somewhere else to actually send that information to our brain.
Eric Chudler, killing my whole buzz. He's a neuroscientist at the University of Washington. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week we're thinking about our senses. So we just heard how subtle and sensitive our sense of touch can be, or I should say senses. You know, that means we take in a lot of information about the world through our hands. There are plenty of people who get along without hands. Prosthetics and robotics have made huge leaps, but you know, those can set you back like $100,000. There is a lower tech solution, and it costs less than a decent dinner date. It's made with a 3D printer. KPLU's Jennifer Wing has the story.
In the basement of a house in Burien, 20-year-old Peregrine Hawthorne shows me his three hands dangling from a cord. He loves them and put most of them together himself. They look like they belong on a robot. The components of each hand were made by a 3D printer for about $50 with the help of an organization called Enable. Peregrine shows me one of them called the Cyborg Beast.
It's not the strongest hand I've ever used.
When Peregrine straps it onto his wrist and flexes down, tendons made out of fishing line tighten, and all of the large boxy fingers close shut. Another hand he put together is the Raptor.
This right here is kind of the staple hand that we give to most people right now. And this one works pretty well.
From the time he was little, Peregrine was hardwired to be left-handed, but his left hand could never hold on to whatever it was he was after. A toy, a book, a treat. He'd reach out for it, but couldn't grasp it. The hand has no fingers. It's a palm with five little fleshy nubs. He was born that way. Today, his left hand moves ladders and rips blackberries from the ground thanks to his latest model, the Talon. Its black fingers are shiny. Peregrine used a vegetable steamer to bathe it in acetone. The fingers close without a squeak thanks to the beeswax that was rubbed into the joints.
And unlike all the other models, it uses leather in the most of the design, actually. There's no plastic or foam or anything that touches my skin at all. And the leather is a really nice material. I mean, we've been using it forever, pretty much. And it's conformed to the shape of my arm, the shape of my hand. And I've even got, I managed to get a little embossing in the top. Cyborg pride. I view myself as a cyborg now. It's become a part of my body and part of my identity.
Peregrine has his own 3D printer the size of a bread box. He talks online with prosthetic designers all over the world about how to make these hands better. On this day, he's getting ready to print some replacement fingers. He sprays some Aquanet onto the tray inside the printer so the plastic will stay in one spot.
And the fingers, how long did it say it'll take? Preview, 11 hours, 35 minutes.
So it'll be going all day.
Pretty much, yeah.
In his cramped, messy room, his bed is in the corner, inches away from his desk and computer. Old 3D printing projects sit on a shelf. One of them is a white Tyrannosaurus Rex skull, a little bigger than a softball. It's supposed to screw onto a shower head so the water shoots out of its mouth. Shelves are filled with books, poster art, and prints of Japanese landscapes cover the walls. Peregrine shuts all of this out. He's laser-focused on his work. He wasn't always this way. A few years ago, he was one of those students
that teachers said had lots of potential but didn't apply themselves.
If you asked him what he wanted to do with his life, he said everything.
And then did nothing.
Now, when Peregrine looks down at his Enable hand, the Talon, the desire to tinker and improve extends to the rest of his life.
You start to look at your entire self as something that is worthy of being upgraded, and you see yourself as a work in progress. Anything that you can't do today is not because you can't do it, it's because you can't do it yet, and that a future version of you could do that if you work at upgrading and improving yourself.
Before I tell you about Peregrine's plans to upgrade himself, let's head over to a lab. It's at the University of Washington Bothell campus. It's the size of an average classroom. A bank of 3D printers is humming along one wall. This is where 30 students work in teams to make the 3D printed hand more lifelike. Cameron Ramsey Whalen, a 23-year-old mechanical engineer major, is figuring out how to make it possible for people who wear them to really feel what they're touching. It involves strapping an ultrasound band to a person's chest.
Yeah, it would be a chest strap that has these devices across just the pectoral muscle that is adjacent to the amputated arm.
A small Bluetooth device would wirelessly send signals from the hand to the chest. This would only work for people who once had a hand with fingers and then lost it somehow. An accident, cancer. Cameron says the sound waves from the ultrasound would tickle the nerves that were severed and wake them up.
Exactly. So you'd have your prosthetic hand that has sensors that are able to determine or basically emit voltages or signals that are directly related to the amount of pressure that's being applied to the finger. Those signals are relayed to what are called ultrasonic transducers, little devices that, when fed an electrical signal, will produce sound waves. And those sound waves can penetrate the skin and engage nerves at depth in the tissue.
Other students are designing a rotating wrist. Another team is trying to make it so the thumb on the 3D printed hand can be put in different positions. One kid who's waiting for a better thumb on his plastic hand is 13-year-old Dawson Riverman in Forest Grove, Oregon, west of Portland. Like Peregrine, Dawson has a left palm, but no fingers. He'd love it if the thumb on his plastic hand had a little dexterity to work a joystick when he plays his favorite video game, Destiny.
The buttons, I can't just grab them with all four fingers because it doesn't work very well. And the thumb doesn't move the joystick very well at all.
Okay, so for video games, the hand is a little clunky. But there's a lot of other things that the hand makes it possible for Dawson to do. He can play basketball.
I'm good at using it for dribbling and shooting.
He uses it for soccer when he's goalie. He can ride his bike with two hands on the handlebars. Dawson is a growing boy. He's going on his third hand now. His mother, Dawn, remembers when they came home with the first one.
He was so excited, and he ran over to the neighbors, and he was showing it to them, showing it what it did. And then I hear this, Mom, come here. And I went outside, and he goes, I can pick up a bat with two hands. For the first time, he was able to hold it with two hands.
Dawn says this inexpensive piece of plastic has changed her son's life. Yes, he was able to get around fine before the hand, but now, for the first time, he has something other kids want but can't have. It's that cyborg appeal that's now part of Peregrine's identity. Pre-cyborg, Peregrine was so ambivalent about school he didn't bother going to graduation. Today, he's studying calculus online. He gets up and goes for a run in the morning.
Not something I used to do, ever. If you saw me running down the street in high school, it was because someone was chasing me.
He wants to go to Rochester Institute of Technology in New York to study biomechanical engineering.
They said that I didn't get accepted in.
But the updated version of Peregrine isn't letting that stop him. He's moving to New York State, where he'll go to community college, get some traction, and then reapply. He continues to improve and test the Enable 3D printed hand, which so far has been paired with more than 1,000 people around the world.
I mean, I'm fully prepared to go, full Iron Man with this.
Future models still in the works are the Falcon, the Kestrel, and the Osprey. Maybe it'll be Peregrine who comes up with the perfect design that'll make it possible for Dawson to clean up when he plays Destiny.
That story from KPLU's Jennifer Wing. Just ahead, a unique family business in Kirkland, hand-painting artificial eyes. That's coming up on Sound Effect from KPLU. We're thinking about our senses today on Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is a story about a family. And there's no getting around this. Someone gets hurt in this story. But that incident becomes a pivotal moment for the family's history. And it's what led them to discover their life's work. That work, which happens in a medical office park in Kirkland, is making eyes.
I'm a licensed ocularist. And ocularist is an artificial eye maker.
Todd Cranmore makes eyes for people who have lost or damaged their eyes because of accidents or cancer or birth defects.
So come on down this way.
And if you assume that prosthetic eyes are made with 3D scanners and lasers and stuff like I did, think again.
All of our process is hand done. It's done with the patient right in front of us, just a few inches away. My eyeballs are glued to their eyeballs and trying to pick out the colors and the patterns.
That turns out to be very difficult. It's part art, part science. Todd studies the patient's remaining eye, if there is one, and tries to perfectly match the delicate patterns with his paintbrush.
We have cobalt blue.
The colors get stacked in layer after layer, 100 or more of them in just one iris.
Building all the way from the back to the front. So we start adding texture and color and actually depth.
This is a pretty specialized profession. There's just 4 licensed ocularist practices in Washington. There's no school. They all learn through apprenticeship. And they're all trying to capture this most mysterious part of human anatomy.
There's nothing else on our bodies that are that captivating. Kind of like a flower. It's a beacon. It's the life. It's the windows of the soul. What a challenge to try to duplicate an iris and try to make something that is plastic and pigment look alive.
That plastic, specifically acrylic, is what prosthetic eyes are made of. Todd says most people ask him if they're made of glass. The answer is not since World War II.
Another question is how I got into the field. And that's a pretty common question.
And that's a long answer for you.
That can be a long answer.
That answer starts with the other two main characters in this story.
Yes, my name's Christy Erickson. I'm an ocularist. Todd Cranmore is my son. Timothy Cranmore, patient, is my son.
My name is Tim Cranmore, and I'm the brother of Todd Cranmore and the son of Christy Erickson.
How Christy and Todd went into business together making eyes goes back to a summer day in 1976. The family was living in a rural area just outside of Monroe, Washington. Todd was just a year and a half old. His big brother Tim was three. Baby Colleen was just 2 weeks.
It was near 4th of July because we were having a party.
We had a family gathering at our house.
It's about mid-afternoon, and my husband and his brother.
And my dad and my uncle went to go work out on the tractor.
We had a backhoe.
And of course, being a young boy, I wanted to go out with them.
Tim was just playing outside, just watching, sitting on the ground watching.
I remember him saying, no, stay here. And I put up a pretty big fuss that I wanted to go out. So they finally agreed to let me go out and watch.
And it had a bolt on it that they were trying to take off with these great big old bolt cutters.
Apparently they were using some bolt cutters to cut a bolt off the tractor.
And so when they ended up cutting this bolt, and the bolt flew right in his eye.
It ricocheted off and skimmed the edge of my eye.
It must have been like a one in a bazillion shot.
Right. You know, what are the chances of that tiny piece of metal hitting you right in the eye?
I do remember I was inside with the baby.
I remember him kind of picking me up and looking at me, like all concerned. And I remember looking at him, and I saw like a little blood above his eyebrow. So, you know, I was worried about him because I actually saw blood, and I couldn't figure out why they were looking at me. I don't remember feeling any pain.
They, of course, did emergency surgery that night. I think it was a Sunday night. The ophthalmologist, the surgeon, he came out and told us that, you know, it was all collapsed, and it looked like something exploded inside of Tim's eye.
At 3 years old, Tim lost vision in his right eye. Christy was afraid he'd forever be bumping into things, he'd never ride a bike, but Tim figured most of that stuff out. He was a resilient kid. Christy's marriage didn't bounce back so well.
My husband then started to act out. He was really, you know, getting pretty mean with the kids. That was kind of the starting.
Did you hold him responsible for what happened to Tim?
No, I didn't, but he did. And he's unwilling to talk to anybody about it.
By the time Tim was ready to start kindergarten, his eye had shrunk back into its socket. His parents started to worry about how other kids at school would treat him, so someone suggested they look into getting Tim an artificial eye.
I met Gerald Erickson, was the ocularist. I was really impressed with the office. I met patients, and even there was a child. And it was just a close, secure feeling to have, to be understood.
Jerry made Tim's first prosthetic, what's called a scleral shell that fits over the withered eye, a cool blue to match the left. And Christy took an immediate interest in the craft of this, and in the craftsman.
I ended up divorcing my first husband and married Jerry Erickson.
Christy became Jerry's office assistant, and then his apprentice, and eventually his colleague. And meanwhile, Tim was growing up, learning to live with a fake eye. That was not always easy.
It would get around, especially in grade school, that this is the guy with the glass eye, and everybody would want to see it, or they want me to take it out. They would give me money to take out the eye. So they would, you know, conjure up a quarter or 50 cents or whatever it was, and I didn't really care what the amount was. It was more of a peer pressure thing. You know, one person would ask, then all of a sudden you'd have this whole group of kids around you waiting for you to take out your eye. So.
Did you hate that? What was that like?
Yeah, I definitely hated it. You know, I didn't want the attention.
Tim still doesn't really like attracting attention. But now he's a handsome professional guy with blonde hair and close-cropped reddish beard. He's been through 7 or 8 eyes since that first one. You have to replace them every few years. And today, Tim is back in the office to sit for a new eye.
Gee, I didn't think there would be room for improvement, but there is room for improvement. What do you have?
Well, it's been a while. I didn't realize how long it's been. We were like, oh, wow, it's 2007, so.
Is that like the cobbler's children don't get?
All those new shoes.
Shoes. Yeah.
Over the years, Tim has had eyes made by his stepdad, his mother, his stepsister, and the last few times by his brother Todd. It's Todd's turn again.
All right, well, let's start painting.
Have fun, you guys.
In the painting room, the family resemblance is obvious. If you just walked in here, you might think you were looking at two brothers recreating some epic staring contest from their childhood.
It's hard not to laugh or anything. Like, you're looking each other in the eye, and you're just, it's supposed to be serious. And, you know, you think of kids like, stop looking at me or don't stare at me.
The process starts with a curved disc of acrylic. This will become the iris.
So I'm getting set up to put your pupil in. What I want to do is set your pupil first, because it's going to be offset, and then all the radial patterns I want to paint out.
Then Todd sets about recreating his brother's steely blue, which turns out to contain hardly any blue at all. It's mostly grays and whites and yellows, all delicately stacked on top of each other.
We're trying to make a 3D effect, because the muscle, the iris, has crypts and it's got peaks and it has all these different folds in it, and so you really don't want to try to create like a wheel. You want it to look like tissue.
The eye also has to be a perfect fit. So Todd takes an impression of Tim's eye socket.
And then if you can, bring your chin up a little higher. Perfect.
Todd injects a gel into the empty socket and lets it harden. It works just like a dental impression.
And you're going to feel the cool come in now. Feel it come in?
Mm-hmm. When he pulls it out, he has a perfect mold of where the new prosthesis will fit.
Now it's just about set up now. You might feel a little bit of a pull on your eyelashes here as this comes out. Great.
Later, Todd will carefully fray red silk thread to make the blood vessels. The effect all this has is to make the prosthesis almost indistinguishable from the natural eye. It's really uncanny. Of course, there are some tells. In the dark, Tim's live pupil dilates while his painted one doesn't. The prosthetic eye doesn't move that much, and Tim is hyper aware of when people notice.
You know, especially when I was younger, talking to girls, I was shy in general, and then if I think they're trying to check out my eye a little bit, I'll be even more shy and kind of back away and kind of distracts me, and that's been a big hurdle to get over.
Sounds like you've been burned once or twice.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I've had some, you know, dates in the past where the subject of the eye comes up. You know, I have 5 great dates in a row. Things seem to be going really well. And as soon as they go, oh, what's wrong with your eye? And then I tell them what happened. And that's the last you hear from them.
We tend to think of someone's eyes as such a part of their personhood. When someone's missing one, people can be weird about it. And that's why the process of Todd painstakingly recreating his brother's eye is such an intimate act.
But I feel blessed to have this option instead of just wearing a patch over your eye or just being a pirate the rest of your life or something, but kind of nice to be able to just be an everyday person.
Look at that detail. Now, is that a detail man or a woohoo?
How's it look to you, Tim?
That looks great.
Does it look familiar?
Yeah, yes.
Christy clearly relishes seeing her sons together.
Great.
Maybe any mom would, but here, right, we'll in this office, it feels like putting something back together.
I always just kind of want to revert back to when they shared bedrooms and things, or when they climbed on the roof and found out later. I'm just totally proud.
And to have something taken from you as a young mom and taken from Tim, does this feel like you're restoring it in some way? I mean, it must feel like it's coming full circle.
Yeah, that's a really great way to state it. That satisfied feeling that you get when it's like, who would have thunk it?
Who would have thunk on that July day in 1976 that the family would end up here, together, making Tim whole again?
What's up, Todd?
Tim's wearing his eyeball. You can go take a look at him.
Timbo! Whoa! That's beautiful. How's your eye feel?
Definitely feels really good.
For at least the next 5 years or so, this eye will go to sleep with Tim and wake with him. It'll go on dates and droop after long days of work, and yes, probably even cry with him. Tim still has his tear ducts. This eye will be in all the family photos. And that makes sense, because both of his eyes are gifts from his family.
I think it's a neat thing to be able to hand over the mirror and be able to let go and say, here's this thing that we made, and it's my hands, it's my mom's hands, but I want my brother to have ownership and to feel like it is his eye. It is not our eye any longer. It's his eye.
You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our show this week is all about senses. So this next story is about a sense of hearing, but also a sense of community. What you're hearing right now is from the Sorrento Hotel on First Hill in Seattle. And the Sorrento, if you haven't seen it, it's this seven-story tall, ornate, Italian Renaissance-style hotel. It opened in 1909. KPLU's Ed Ronco went there for something called a silent reading party. And he's here now to tell us more about it. Hey, Ed.
Hello, Gabriel.
So we're hearing sound from inside the fireside room at the Sorrento. What is that space like?
All right, it's this big hexagonal room right off the lobby. There's dark wood paneling on the walls, big column right in the middle of the room, and the lights are subdued. There's a baby grand piano and a giant fireplace that's kind of outlined in green tile.
Oh, sounds cozy.
It is.
Right, so what's going on right now?
It's early evening. The room is filling up with people. Some of them have books. Some of them have Kindles or tablets. And then, right at 6, without any prompting, the room falls absolutely silent.
Really?
Okay, that might be a little too silent. Hold on. There. That's about right. You can still hear some background noise as people get drinks, and there's, you know, waitstaff circulating throughout the room, but the conversations have stopped. The books are opened, eventually a piano player shows up and adds some live music. Every seat is taken, people are on the floor, and all of them are reading in silence.
Why are you doing this?
All right, for that answer, let's turn to Christopher Frizzell. He's the editor-in-chief of The Stranger and one of the founders of the silent reading parties. He talks a little bit about how it got started and what exactly is going on right now.
It came from a couple Stranger critics 10 years ago, realizing at the end of a workday, oh, we all have to go home and read. I need to go home because I'm reviewing this book. And we went to the grocery store and bought figs and cheese and whiskey and chocolate and had a great time sitting around, mostly not talking to each other, but occasionally talking to each other. I really wanted to read at bars and have a drink and read, but a lot of bars aren't lit for reading. And a lot of the bars that are, the people who are there get insulted if you're sitting there reading. I've had so many interactions in bars where people say things like, don't you know you're in a bar, or must be a really good book, or, you know, they get kind of weirdly offended or as if you're trying to prove that you know how to read, or I don't know why they get so offended, but there's a strange thing where it's a violation of the social code if you're in a bar where everybody's socializing for you to be sitting at the bar reading. And I really wanted that opposite to be true. What scenario would mean everybody in the bar gets to read?
Did you think when you said let's give this a try, people would actually show up to this?
No, I really thought it was a silly idea born of my own social interactions. And to this day, it surprises me the number of people that show up.
What's social about reading for you when you're not actually reading to other people or the same thing as other people?
It's not that it's social. It's more like I don't want to be alone. It's more like I want to read, and I also want to combat the loneliness of reading. And I feel like if people hang out together and read together, and occasionally, you know, someone will lean over and say, you got to read this paragraph, or they'll start cracking up and you'll take an interest because you just can't help it. Occasionally people pass notes, which I strongly encourage. I think it's really adorable. And people talk afterward. I mean, people, when you're not allowed to make small talk, all you want to do is make small talk. It's so strange. It's really funny to watch these people like repressing their desire to speak up. And then 8 o'clock comes and they're like, oh my God, okay, so I just read this thing. And then, and it's great. They're actually excited to talk to people in a room where they might not be excited otherwise. It's a city thing. It's a literary thing. It's a social thing. It's a bar thing. They have art that changes in this room, so it's kind of an art thing too. There's a lot about it that's still beyond my ability to grasp. I think the first couple years it was rare that it was really full. It would be full every other time or every three times. Now it's pretty consistently always full and sometimes way too full. But it's not empty like it used to be.
What has made it last?
I don't know. Here's the surprise. Yeah. The surprise is I'm sitting in a room with 80 people. There's five strangers to a couch. There's no room. There are people sitting on the floor because they want to be in this room, even though nothing's going to happen. They can just go home and sit in a chair and read. But they want to be part of this group thing. They just want to be part of a social fabric. And yet they also want to get some reading done. They're a person who's got a book that they've been meaning to get to, or a book they're really wrapped up in. And what's surprising to me is the number of people who want to sit on the floor. That's how excited they are to be in the room, even though literally nothing's going to happen.
It sounds a little like the first scene in a romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
People make eyes across the room at each other. I mean, it's...
God, I hope so. Yeah, I hope that's happened.
Yeah.
It's got to happen soon. I mean, we've been doing this for 5 years, and there is definitely a flirtatious vibe, I think. Especially, there's lots of young people, lots of heterosexual people. I wish there were more gay people, personally. And it's there's something sexy about it. Being all together, everybody reading in their books and sort of unavailable mentally, there's something that draws you toward a person who's reading. And I really like that vibe.
Did more people come, say, in 2008 because the economy crashed and it was something free to do? Mm. Or, I mean, I just wonder if, like, world events or local events shape who shows up.
That's so funny. I don't think so. I mean, I think the more time has gone by, the more people come. I think that's all it is. For a while, we had special guests, which was also sort of an inside joke because the special guests didn't say anything or do anything. They just literally sat there and read whatever they felt like, and then they went home. Really, what calls attention to it is word of mouth and how unusual it is. And I think there is a deep-seated desire in the culture to reconnect with literature. And there are very few opportunities to be encouraged to.
We're such a tech-heavy culture. We're such a on-the-go, it feels like, you know, culture. Sitting around in silence, reading something that's ink and paper, that would be so popular is, I think, very surprising.
It's bizarre. It's wonderful.
Is it rude to ask what somebody's reading at one of these things?
I hope not. I think that's the only way to actually start the conversation.
What are you reading?
I'm reading The Waves by Virginia Woolf. I like it, although I don't like it as much as I liked To the Lighthouse, which I read about a month ago. And I read it twice. It was so good. And to this day, I walk down the street and think about that book and just start bawling.
That was Christopher Frizzell, editor-in-chief of The Stranger and co-founder of Seattle's Silent Reading Party. He spoke to KPLU's Ed Ronco. The piano music you're hearing is courtesy of Paul Matthew Moore. You can see what the sound effect team is reading on our website, kplusoundeffect.org. The Silent Reading Party happens the first Wednesday of every month at the Sorrento Hotel on Seattle's First Hill. It starts at 6 o'clock, but if you want to sit on actual furniture, you should get there early. Sound Effect is produced by Arwen Nix and Kevin Kniestad. We had stories this week from KPLU's Jennifer Wing and Ed Ronco. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We had web help from Mike Lewis. To see some pictures of the prosthetic eyes, you can go to kplusoundeffect.org. Email your feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org or write a review on iTunes. Come on back next week when we'll give you the dirt on dirt.
It's like I don't know how else to write unless I'm like talking about people. I'll tattle on myself as much as I'll talk about what other people are doing.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.